Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Well, it's San Diego week, and as the date approaches and the festival begins on Wednesday, we're going to be presenting a few Road to San Diego interviews on tonight's episode of Word Balloon. Two subjects, Hilary Barda, who will be there as part of the Creepy group for Dark Horse, because Creepy is back, and issue one just came out last week, and Hilary's got a wonderful two-page story in there that you're going to love. And if you love the old Creepy magazine, I can't endorse enough the new Creepy magazine, because not only do they get back such wonderful talents as Alex Toth, a wonderful old Alex Toth story, and Angelo Torres has a story in there as well. But guys like Jason Alexander and Hilary Barda continue the tradition of Creepy and draw some wonderful, wonderful stories. And we'll be talking about that with Hilary. Also, his work on the Red Circle line. Hilary is inking the web, drawn by Roger Robinson and written by Angela Robinson. We'll be talking about that and Hillary's plans in San Diego. In addition to that, Dave McKean was in town in Chicago promoting a series of paintings he's done based on silent horror films from the early 1900s. Now, the group of paintings is called Nitrate. He's taking one of those paintings with him to San Diego and will be doing a signing at the Century Guild booth. And we're going to talk about that, the series of paintings, the inspirations behind them, a nice impromptu conversation we had with Dave McKean live at the Portage Theater in Chicago, amidst this showing of his art and also a viewing of a bunch of his short films, including Mirror Mask, one of his many collaborations with Neil Gaiman. I should point out that the Dave McKean interview was actually shot for video, and I've put together a video that you can find at the front page of wordballoon.com, and it's much more illustrative, obviously. You'll see the paintings that we talk about. In addition to that, you will see stills of the silent films that the paintings were inspired by. So make sure that you go over to wordballoon.com, check out the video interview version of our talk with Dave McKean as well. So a quick talk with Dave and a good catch-up with Hilary Barda, all today on the Road to San Diego here on Word Balloon, where today's show is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where you'll find a huge selection of hardcovers, absolute editions, archives, trade paperbacks, you name it, they've got them, with discounts that start at 35% off the cover price and up. And in addition to that, if you place orders of $50 or more at InStockTrades.com, you get free shipping. Case in point, one of the subjects we're talking about today, Creepy. How about the Creepy Archives? All three volumes are available from InStockTrades.com. The standard retail price is $49.95, but at InStockTrades.com, just $32.47. As for Dave McKean, how about the very creepy and very appropriate Signal to Noise, the second edition hardcover? Neil Gaiman and Dave McKean presenting their masterpiece in a completely remastered and redesigned edition, overflowing with bonus material from McKean. You get three related short stories unseen in two decades, an additional chapter created for the CD release of the radio series. The standard retail price for this is $24.95 at InStockTrades.com, $16.22. For more details, make sure you visit their website, InStockTrades.com. Let's start things off with my phone conversation with Hilary Barda, the wonderful artist and inker of such great characters as Splash Brannigan, Plastic Man. We look forward to his debut as inker on the web for the Red Circle Heroes on DC's line. But to start things off, we talk about his work for the Dark Horse return of Creepy. Well, Hilary, I got to tell you, in my hands, I have issue one of Creepy. And first of all, I'm so glad this is back, because I think Dark Horse has done a tremendous job with the Creepy and Eerie archives and the beautiful hardcover editions that they've done. And it's nice to see that it looks like the tradition is continuing now in these 48-page new issues. And I know you have a great story in there. What can you tell us about your continuing feature in Creepy?
Well, it's called Loathsome Lore, which is the sort of historical horror feature that Creepy used to run, and they're reviving it. The first one that you've got in your hands, apparently, I haven't seen the first issue yet, so I'm kind of excited. It just came out. But the first one is, they always pick a subject, you know, and they sort of talk about that subject throughout history. And this one is Deals with the Devil, Faustian Deals. And, yeah, I was kind of surprised when I got the script, because, you know, I know the story of Faust and everything. I don't exactly know it as history so much as maybe legend, perhaps. But then the same story is Sammy Davis Jr. and Jane Mansfield, and I'm laughing going, what? What? Well, how, what do they have to do with this? You know, and I was told that apparently these characters, these famous people, have were at least reported to have had some dealings with the Church of Satan, if not Satan himself. So that's why they're in there.
Well, I know one of the characters depicted is Robert Johnson.
Well, now, there you go. Now, that's a little more well-known, the sort of
sure. The
story of him at the crossroads where he gets his talent from the devil. He makes a deal, he sells his soul for...
Yeah, that's the legend. And actually,
right.
there's a great documentary that just came out, or maybe it's an older one, but I know I've seen it on cable recently. Morgan Freeman owns a blues club that's right by the actual crossroads where that supposedly took place. And it's called, like, Last of the Amboy Jukes and stuff, and it's just this, like, little history of this cool little blues stage. And they talk about the Robert Johnson thing there. You know, I just talked to David McKean, and I can't help but notice he has done a series of paintings about silent films, and one of the subjects that he chose was F.W. Murnau's film Faust. And it looks like, and tell me if I'm correct, that your depiction of Faust looks like it was also inspired by the silent film. Am I correct?
I think inspired might be a mild word there. No, yeah, definitely. I wanted to. I mean, if anyone out there has seen the film Faust, they'd know why Dave and I had used the visuals. It's a beautiful, gorgeous film. A really incredible German expressionism with great design and the lighting. And oh God, it's just one shot after another that. When I finally saw it, I actually didn't see it until just like a couple of years ago, actually. I've seen a lot of Murnau, but I haven't seen that one yet.
Well, and I know...
Man, Wrightson, probably Bernie Wrightson and all these different artists were probably, using this as inspiration for many years because there's just classic scenes about Laboratory and others that I go, man, I've seen this in a horror comic somewhere before, you know.
Well, it looks great. And also, another reason why I'm enjoying this revival of Creepy is... I'm really glad they made the decision to keep it black and white. And I think that really is a hallmark of what Creepy was. And, it really seems like Dark Horse is exploiting that in the best way possible. Some of the stories are really in very lush gray tones. Your story turned out great. And I just love the look of the book. And, you know, are you pleased that your stuff is in? You know, would you have rather seen it colored, or are you happy that it is black and white?
Well, I got to say that I love black and white. In fact, you know, like we were talking about Murnau's Faust, and black and white film is probably the number one inspiration for the way I picture things. I see things in terms of lighting. And, in fact, color is an odd thing for me in comics because I seldom do it myself. So there's a sort of disconnect between the way I picture things and the way they finally come out because no matter what you do in the artwork, it's not going to, you know, there's this other layer and this other sensibility coming on top of it. So when you do stuff in black and white, you're in total control of it. And I love gray tones, and I was very happy to do this story and perhaps future ones. I'm not sure if I'll always use wash, but I don't think I've used wash prior to this creepy story. I don't think I've used wash in, you know, over 20 years. There was never a place to do it. And, you know, I didn't know what the heck I was doing. Friends asked me, oh, did you use gouache? Did you do this and that? I said, I just watered down the ink. You know, I don't know. But I had a blast. It was so much fun. And, I'm very happy. I can't wait to see the book, which you have and I don't. I can't wait to actually see what other people did with it because, frankly, I wish there were more comics in black and white. It's a wonderful way to work, yeah.
Well, and I also think that... It seems to me that maybe because we're a little older than today's comic fans or some of today's comic fans, that we kind of grew up in a world where black and white media was alongside the color stuff, and especially in the late 60s and early 70s. So maybe we don't blink as much. And then certainly, you know, Creepy was always a black and white book, and it never occurred to me that that was a wrong choice or that that should be odd compared to what was on the spinner rack, say, in the early 70s.
No, you're right. I mean, it doesn't feel odd to me at all. And I grew up, as you did, I'm sure, with black and white television and black and white films that were shown in one theater and the color film would be shown in the next one. But especially when it comes to horror, even though EC Comics were color, they did end up doing some black and white, you know, books. But they... they also, you know, just, excuse me, but not so much comics, but television, all of the dramatic shows that I think of when I think of horror, I think of, you know, whether it be a fantasy show, something like Twilight Zone, you know, science fiction, fantasy horror, or...
Outer Limits.
Yeah, Boris Karloff's Thriller.
Thriller, yeah. Thing. Oh, yeah.
All those shows, I think, you know, black and white is what I associate it with. So black and white and horror, to me, you know, they really, you know, and plus the classic Universal horror films, which are still the horror films for me. Even though they were made before I was born, I grew up watching them on television and late night TV. And so that, yeah, black and white and horror make perfect sense. And black and white, it's a shame that they seldom use black and white anymore. They occasionally do a film in black and white, and there's usually some, it's usually set in the 50s or 40s or something. There's some reason why they use black and white, but it's such a wonderful medium, and whatever. It's apparently people don't want to pay to see it. I can't believe that's true, but that's what they say.
I got to hand it to the writers, Joe Harris, Dan Braun, Mike Woods, Neil Cleed, and Bill Dubay. But once again, I think Creepy was just as much about the art, and you're in good company, man. Jason Alexander, Angela Torres, Saskia Gutek. Boy, this is like a Carrie Carey name. Saskia Gutekunst. Boy, oh boy. He plays left field, of course. Brian Chirilla and the great Alex Toth, along with our own Hillary Barter, plus an Eric Powell cover and a Bernie Wrightson front piece. I mean, this is a feast for the eyes, and I think it's great. Man, Eric did a great job on the cover. It's really gorgeous and very appropriate. And again, you're in cool company, and I was asking you off the air if I'm assuming, obviously, the Toth piece has to be something from the old days, but I'm not sure about the Angela Torres piece, if that was new or old. And I don't even know, like, is, you know, forgive me for asking, is Angela still around?
You know, that's a good question. I think he is, and I think it's the new piece, but you know what, that's just something I assumed, so I don't know.
No problem.
Yeah, I think, I know that, if I'm not mistaken, Angela recently did a EC-inspired piece for Bongo Comics, for their Treehouse of Horror.
Absolutely, which you do work for as well.
Yeah, so I think, so that would, you know, I would imagine unless he's ghosting his own strips, so to speak, I think he's still around.
Excellent, man. Well, you know, this is really a great start, and is it a monthly?
Actually, that's something I don't know, I'm sorry to say.
Okay.
No, I don't know.
I'll look in the
I haven't got my script for the second one yet, so that maybe that means it's a bi-monthly. I don't know. I've heard it's coming soon, but I haven't gotten it yet. So.
That's cool. And I know there's going to be a panel in San Diego for the creepy people as well.
I think it's coming up this coming Friday.
Cool.
And it's 3:30 to 4:30, if I'm not mistaken. But don't quote me on that.
And I imagine you guys will have some signings too at the Dark Horse booth.
Just after that, I think that's at 5:00. Yeah, we're gonna.
Oh, that's great, man. That's great. Well, this is really cool, and I'm looking forward to more of these. Now, we mentioned Bongo Comics. I should ask if you got anything coming up with your more Simpsons work for you.
I don't. I mean, I hope to see the people that I know from there, like Bill Morrison and the other Bongo folks, when I'm in San Diego, and we'll talk about this and why I'm not getting more work from them. But no, it's always an occasional gig. I'm not exactly their sort of regular Bongo artist there. They usually work in an open style animation style line, and I do stuff where I add all the feathering and shadows and stuff, so I don't fit into their usual game plans, and I don't have any stories right now scheduled with them, but I wish I did. I love working with those characters, and always have, so I hope there's more to come, but there's nothing in the offing.
So usually, though, you come in on things like a Radioactive Man story, maybe, or a Treehouse of Horror story, things like that?
Well, the last couple things I've done, very last thing I did was a story for a Bart Simpson book. But prior to that, I'd only been in Radioactive Man and the Treehouse of Horror, where they're a little bit off of the main regular Simpsons line.
Yeah, well, and you know... They want to obviously make it look like the TV show and stuff, and so yeah, I guess when
right.
they do kind of
exactly.
have more atmosphere.
And I'm not really comfortable working that way. I wish I was a bit. To be honest with you, I think you really have to be really good and on model to draw in an open line style. And I just developed a style where It's like I was saying before, I see things, and maybe I said this off the air before we started recording, but I just see things in terms of lighting. I see things in black and white with light and dark shadows, you know, all the lighting set up, and it's hard for me to just think of things as pure design and line. I just don't see them that way. It's actually difficult for me to take that out of the equation and to design things that way. So
that must have been a joy then to work on something like Splash Brannigan back in the day with Alan Moore and really, you know, have a character that essentially was an all-black, inky character and everything. And
well, yeah, I mean, Splash, yeah, right. I was told by a few people who had to draw him, you know, when they were doing covers and stuff, that he was a pain in the ass to draw. And I just said, why? Because to me, he's fun. You can have him do anything you want. And they just said, no, just the actual lighting, because he's black, and you can't do it consistently. You have to cheat a little bit to define all the features on his face, for instance. But basically, you're drawing the highlights. He's as if he's made out of black ink or black anything, glass or something dark, black rock or whatever. And you catch the highlights. So whereas with any other character, you know, you're just they're light, and then you're just drawing in the shadow. So it's a little bit different. But anyway, I enjoy drawing them. And
quickly, let me ask about Plastic Man, because when you think of Splash Brannigan, you can't help but think of Plastic Man. Were the two linked? I mean, was that what Alan had in mind?
Well, I do think that I seem to recall Alan saying this in an interview somewhere, but it was either that he wanted to do another humorous character, and he thought of Jack Cole. And I think it was something along the lines that he was thinking of the great creators of comics, and there was Will Eisner and the Spirit, and that inspired, Cobweb.
Yes.
And, I'm sorry, not Cobweb, but Grayshirt.
Grayshirt.
Cobweb was inspired by something else. But anyway, and so Jack Cole and Plastic Man inspired Splash Brannigan. But, of course, unlike every other creator out there, he didn't just do an imitation of, you know, another rubber guy. He came up with a wholly new creation. In fact, Splash Brannigan is equally influenced by the Fleischer sort of Out of the Inkwell series and the various characters.
Coco the Clown and people like
that?
Yeah,
characters that were literally, you know, a kind of ink and sort of imagination, you know, part imagination and part real being. I mean, I think that's part of the whole thing. I think he sort of merged those two ideas of Plastic Man, the shape-shifting, humorous character, you know, with this other sort of blending it with the artistic creation that came out of the Inkwell.
You know, Xander Cannon and Gene Ha really had a nice run that unfortunately was cut short coming back to Top 10 for America's Best Comics and Wildstorm. Would that be something that, A, you'd want to do, is come back to Splash at all? Or do you feel like, if Alan's not doing it, then I'm not doing it?
Well, in fact, I drew a story that I enjoyed quite a bit that was written by another writer. His name is Hogan, Peter Hogan.
Yes.
A friend of Alan's.
I was going to say, he did a lot of Tom Strong stuff, as I recall.
Yeah, yeah, he really did start writing a lot of the stories at ABC when Alan was cutting back, or after Alan had left. I'm not sure exactly what was going on at that point. But anyway, yeah, he did a lot of that stuff, and that was a blast. I certainly would have done more with Peter. I do Splash anytime, anywhere, I think. I did even submit, when I noticed that other writers were writing stories for different characters, I submitted, I pitched a one-shot or some stories of Splash, and it didn't go anywhere. They just, they really didn't want to do the character without Alan at that point. So, I don't know if it'll ever happen without Alan for that reason, but I would love to do it, and if they ever want to do it with me writing it, I certainly would.
That's cool, and I got to hit you up for a Splash at some point sketch. Maybe I'm going to have to arrange for a commission or something like that and pay some coin.
We can do that off the air.
There you go. There you go. and briefly, because the issue hasn't come out yet, but I know everyone is excited about the Red Circle Heroes coming back, and you play a part in that as well. You are inking the web, and you're with Roger Robinson and Angela Robinson writing, and Angela has a unique background, being from what you told me off the air, the first African American woman to be writing a superhero story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they document that sort of thing, but that's what I believe Roger was telling me this, and I found that, fascinating and cool, that, hey, right?
Yeah.
She apparently is a writer whose background is in television. She's worked on cable shows such as Hung and The L Word, excuse me. And I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with her. I haven't spoken to her yet, but looking forward to seeing what her, you know, what her scripts are and her take on this particular character, if not the comics in general. So yeah, that's kind of exciting.
Absolutely, man.
And Roger is someone that I've just started working with. We did an issue of The Blue Beetle, Brave and the Bold. That was our first artistic meeting, and then we started in on the web. And the first web was this the one shot that was part of the Red Circle thing that J. Michael Straczynski wrote. So that, you know, that was the launch of the new character, the new web.
That's great. Now, yeah, that isn't out yet. I guess it's coming out, I want to say, in August.
If that's what you've heard, I'm sure that's true. I think that sounds right. That just, yeah, it rings a bell. I'm not sure, but I think so.
I think that's the case. And then, yeah, that's cool that they're following up already with a regular series. So that's great. These are characters that I really found fun as a kid, and I remember reading reprints of them in the 70s. And I have the same feeling seeing the public domain heroes that Alex Ross and the Dynamite guys are working with superpowers, in terms of these cool costumes that it's fun to now take these ideas, put a new spin on them, including a new character design. And these are like these great blank slates that you guys can kind of come in and do all these interesting new things with these people. So that's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, just the thing about comics is there is this amazing history, and a lot of it's kind of goofy. I mean, there's a lot of oddball characters that they created back when, you know, they were trying to publish, like, you know, what, 100 comics a month back in the 40s or whatever. And they all had, you know, all comics back then were, practically all comics anyway, were anthology comics. So there were always, like, 5 to 6 features in each book. And some of the backups were pretty strange. But there were just tons of superheroes. And, of course, I guess there's tons of them now, too. But they've all been done, pretty much, you know, and it makes sense to revive some of these characters, especially if they're in the public domain and you can use them. But now I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with the different characters, you know, the Hangman, and,
the Shield,
and all those guys.
Absolutely, man. I'm a big Black Hood fan as well, and I always thought
I always heard that about you.
But no, I what amazed me was that beyond the comics, there were Black Hood pulp novels and also a Black Hood radio series, and I was just stunned. I mean, I was stunned when I found out that the Blue Beetle had a radio series and the Green Llama was a radio character, let alone somebody.
Yeah, Green Llama, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm surprised when the 70s came around and the blaxploitation films started happening, they didn't come out with a Black Hood movie series, you know? But that's a whole other genre.
That's true.
That would have meant something else altogether.
Maybe, actually. Yeah, but you know something? I could see, like, Fred Williamson or Jim Brown being a defiant Black Hood and
yeah,
causing some trouble. So, actually, that'd be a pretty
taking
good
it
idea.
To the man, yeah.
Did you hear they're actually, there's a new blaxploitation parody that I think is coming out soon. Phil Morris, Greg Morris's son, who was Jackie Childs on Seinfeld, I ran into him at the at the New York Con this year, and he was telling me, and it's called Black Dynamite. And
I did hear about this. In fact, it may have been either written up somewhere. Anyway, I read something on it, and it sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
It sounded very good. It might have actually been premiering somewhere around here recently, like a sneak or something.
No, I think it is done, and yeah, I think you're right. I think they are kind of like looking for a major distribution and are kind of sneaking it at festivals or little events and stuff to kind of get the ball rolling. And I know that's why Phil was in New York, was to talk about it and stuff. So we'll see what happens with that. But back to the world of Hillary Barta.
Sorry, didn't mean to derail you there.
Quick, we've never talked about Plastic Man, your great run on it back in the 80s. And who was your writer? I'm blanking. I can't remember who wrote it.
Well, Phil Folio was the writer. And the stories themselves, Doug Rice and I and Phil just sort of sat down and came up with a bunch of ideas at one point and talked through the series. And I think Phil, I'm not saying he got all the story ideas from us, but a lot of the stuff came out of that conversation. And he wasn't terribly familiar with the character when he got offered the book, and he didn't want to draw it, and that's how I came in. You know, I guess Phil recommended me, or somehow I finagled my win there. I think I told him he was crazy for not wanting, you know, for turning it down. And I said, well, you should write it, and I'll draw it. Maybe that's how it happened. I can imagine I probably grabbed him and said, you've got to do it. I want to draw it.
And, you know, people will go back to those old Jack Cole plastic bands in the 40s, and there's too much reverence about them not to acknowledge their greatness. But, you know, can you tell me what you loved about Plastic Man that, you know, made it a fun character for you, or a spirit of what Jack Cole brought to the character and everything? Is that the best representation of what Jack Cole did as far as comics and stuff?
Well, I mean, there's people that will argue about, you know, some people love his crime comics. And
sure.
You know, Art Spiegelman might say that Morphine and Me is the greatest story Jack Cole ever did,
okay,
or whatever. But I have a particular fondness for Plastic Man, but I love just about everything he did, and I've got a, you know, I own a number of Plastic Mans. I did collect his work at a time when I could afford it, and I bought a big run of the Barker. You know, I just which he did some of those, but guys like Claus Nordlinger in there, and I've got some Smash comics, and he did characters in there. So I've read a lot of his stuff, but Plastic Man really is unique. I mean, I think it has a lot to do with the nature of the character. And he was a truly original character, and there aren't many characters in comics you can say that about. And he's the original shape-shifting character. And added on top of that is the fact that most of the stories, not all of them, especially early on, were humorous. And, you know, there's just, Jack Cole did dramatic stories, but he's a really funny guy. And the stories have breakneck pacing, really inventive gags, and this just beautifully designed character that could change his shape to fit the design needed in any given moment. So he was a great character, but he was also a great visual element, you know, to use in designing a page or a panel and a gag, and just a brilliant comic, brilliant artist, yeah, and funny.
Have you kept up with some of the, you know, more recent interpretations of the character when he was in the Justice League, right when Mark Waid was writing it? And
well,
I
can't say that I have. Nothing against those guys and their interpretations. I mean, when I think of interpretations of Plastic Man, I go back to Ramona Fraiden, you know, and Joe Staton and people like that. I mean,
sure.
I liked what they did with the character, in particular Ramona's stuff, which I just thought was really charming. And partly there's an ink line, and I know that the modern versions I've seen, the more recent versions rather that I've seen, you know, they're rendering him in a completely different style. And I like to see the old kind of brushwork and classic sort of liquid brushwork, because it really lends itself to this sort of rubbery character. And Fraiden's, I thought, came the closest to getting that feel of what looked like a Golden Age artist, and that's not surprising, seeing as how that she had, you know, worked. She has a connection to at least the 50s, I guess.
Plus, Metamorpho, I think, adopted the same qualities as Plastic Man and his ability to morph and shapeshift and everything.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a number of characters since then that you know, if not directly patterned after Plastic Man, certainly, you know, carry on that tradition of shape changing and all that. Yeah.
The one thing I like about some of the more recent versions of Plastic Man from a story standpoint that I thought was interesting was the almost discovery, because he is so pliant, that he essentially is immortal. And that is like body chemistry has changed so much that really, I know there was a great Justice League event called the Obsidian War, where literally Plastic Man sat on the ocean floor in pieces for like 1,000 years. and reassembled himself, and it almost like literally like it freaked him out, because it's like, yeah, I was sentient the whole time, slowly kind of piecing myself back together again, and it's like, you can't kill. I mean, you know, the scene was him kind of blowing into a million bits, but after 1,000 years, he was able to reassemble himself. So I thought that was kind of, and it like even like that was the way they kind of had the character exit for a while, in terms of I can't die. I think I got to like wrap my mind around this. I'll see you guys later.
Well, that's rather bizarre. I hadn't heard that, but it does make sense that a guy named Eel O'Brien was living on the ocean floor.
True. Now, there you go. And the other thing, too, is the fact that he was a crook. And I know there's some creators, and I'm not going to spill who, because who knows, maybe this stuff will actually come to print. But I know a lot of people would really like to play more with the fact that this was an ex-criminal that went straight, and you know, how much his criminal past either currently bothers him or informs him as a hero and things like that. And I always thought that was an interesting dimension to play with in the character.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, I think it was kind of a throwaway when, you know, I mean, it was a setup, you know, it was part of the first story. But
sure.
I think once he was established as the hero, I don't think they spent a lot of time in the 40s. Cole didn't, anyway. Spent a lot of time, you know, as you say, developing that and finding out what that meant or how it informed his character. But, you know, the stories back then were pretty much, bam, you know, something happens and they're off and running. Almost literally, they're running after, you know, chasing somebody around. And comics were written very differently then. They were very, they were typically much shorter stories. They were self-contained. They weren't ongoing stories with ongoing, you know, soap operas. And there wasn't room for that kind of development. And in the case of a humorous character, you know, frankly, I don't know why you would need it. But this is a different age, and audience demands different things. So, I don't know.
Well,
I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe they'll do that someday. We'll see.
As we wrap up, I know this week you're getting ready for San Diego, and it is later this week. We've talked about you're going to be on the Creepy Panel. You've hit San Diego the last 2 years, and I missed the last 2 years. I won't be going this year, and I didn't go last year.
You've been avoiding me.
Well, no, I see you plenty in Chicago, actually, sir.
Oh yeah.
But no, I'm curious, as someone who's, you know, experienced San Diego, you know, years ago before the hype machine was really turned on, and it seems like each year since, the hype machine gets louder and louder, and comics has to share the stage now, not only with Hollywood and television, but certainly the gaming world is kind of making its place over there, and of course the Japanese animation and manga as well. What have you thought? Like, what did you think last year of San Diego?
My God, I'm afraid to go now that you said this. They're there too, really? It's not really just a comic convention anymore. Well, look, I think, you know what, you can kind of complain about that. You can say, oh, this is a Comic-Con and whatever. It is what it is. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that comics and movies now, especially, and I suppose that gaming and everything else you mentioned, animation, you know, they're all connected. And whether we like it or not, comics do really need, the business side of it anyway,
sure,
needs their characters to be able to live in other media, because comics just don't make the money. They're not the self-sustaining business that they once were. And it's a horrible, ugly truth, I suppose, as a longtime reader of comics. But I think it's inescapable. And, you know, if comics are run by the other end, that is, if Hollywood dictates what comics are, and if, you know, I know I myself have worked on adaptations of screenplays and movies and things, and they can be good comics. It really depends on how you do it, and you know, whether people are sort of tying your hands and saying, no, you must imitate this other medium. I mean, you know, just because a film is based on a comic book character doesn't mean it is as good as the comics, or doesn't mean it shouldn't be better. I don't know. It is what it is. But the convention itself, it's overwhelming. It's an amazing amount of people and stuff going on, and it's a one big costume show. I mean, when you're sort of like walking outside of the con, and you're sort of trying to get from one place to another, you sort of step out of the main room, and you just walk along, there'll be just groups of people dressed up for one or another, and people taking pictures of them. And I know last year when I was just crossing the street with a bunch of people, you sort of have to wait. You cross where there's this trolley and train tracks and stuff, and you all
yes.
have to wait. And then you all cross, you know, this big throng of people are all moving like a sea across the street. Well, as we were crossing one time, everyone's leaving for lunch, there's like a sea of zombies. I don't know, a sea of zombies, whatever. There's a batch of these people all dressed up as zombies, doing whatever they're tied in with, whatever, you know, movie or whatever it was that they were there with. But they're just doing this, like, performance piece of people dressed up as zombies running up to you, you know, groaning and dragging their feet, and it was hilarious.
That's
it's
cool.
Just like, you know, where else would this happen, you know?
Well, that's the good side of the con. what I was actually getting at, and I understand it. I don't mind comics sharing the stage with some of these other geek pursuits, for a lack of a better word. But what concerned me, but what I kind of found a little off-putting was when the Kim Kardashians and the Paris Hilton start showing up at San Diego as they did last year. I mean, I'm all for celebrities showing up that are promoting genre projects. That's fine. But really, I'm like, Kim Kardashian, why the hell is she here? And it just seems like, you know, sci-fi horror hero.
They were looking for you, John.
Yeah, you know, well, and that, yeah, oops, missed opportunity, obviously, clearly. But yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I even mentioned it to Mike Norton, and, you know, we were laughing and said, yeah, there's a jump the shark moment when Kim Kardashian shows up at the DC Comics party. And it's like, really? What the hell's going on, man? And, like, you know, I think you guys are confused. Sundance is that way. It's like, I don't know. It just seems like, you know, we've got our own heroes and stuff that we look, and our own celebrities that we look forward to seeing, and including people like, you know, I'd say Seth Green and Samuel L. Jackson and Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst and stuff. So, I mean, I'm not anti-Hollywood. It's just, I'm like, those two, I'm like, really?
Well, I had a few moments. I mean, if I was standing there and I saw, you know, Paris Hilton, I probably would stare just at that sort of, you know, like, you know, car crash kind of thing. But, you know, there were a number of actors and TV people that were there at the show. And
Richard Dreyfuss was there.
Well, yeah. And I got on an elevator. Oh, God, who the hell? I'm going to blank on who the different people. But I forget. Ellie Gartner, maybe, is her name. She's one of the characters from Heroes.
Allie Larder.
Lartner. Whatever.
Yeah, I'm
you
probably wrong
me.
Too. I'm probably wrong too, but I know who you're talking about.
But
and everyone listening knows who you're talking about.
I apologize to the lovely young actress.
Yeah, she's a beautiful woman. Absolutely.
And you know, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I've watched the show, and there she is, and that was, you know, it was fun to see her, and Seth Green sitting over there at that table having
sure.
lunch with some people, and he's involved in various comics things, and you know, so there's just these people are, you know, there are plenty of people there, and I think most of the people there like that are involved in comics-related projects, if not comics themselves. So, yeah, I can't really comment on the other thing. I mean, those people just go wherever they go, and, you know, they're like, you know, I suppose they're like flies, you know, that you wave your hand and try to scare them away, but they just keep coming back.
Well, yeah, it just seems like, you know, they kind of heard, okay, there's going to be a lot of people there
there's
and a lot of
scene
studios.
Here, yeah.
Exactly, there's a scene, and that was the word I was thinking of, too. And that, okay, better be there and everything, you know, time
yeah.
for my close-up, and it's like, all right, whatever.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a tough job, but if, you know, if I have to sleep with gorgeous women to get a job in comics, if that's what the future's going to be, I guess I'll have to do it.
Well, good hunting in San Diego, then.
Okay.
I will. I appreciate you coming on, and I know you're going to be at the Windy City Comic Con, and also Chicago Comic Con is coming up as well, so we will see you locally at those two events, and we'll talk more. I'm glad you've agreed to be on one of the panels at the Windy City Con. That I will be presiding over, and we'll talk a little bit more about the way things are going on in comics now as opposed to maybe when you got in the business.
That's right. We'll talk about everything we haven't talked about today.
Excellent, man. Well, thanks for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We switch gears and go to our conversation with Dave McKean, which happened at the Portage Theater on Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago. There was an exhibition there called Nitrate and Kinogeists, and this, of course, was a selection of paintings that Dave has done recently based on horror films of the early 1900s, interesting silent films inspired not only by the images of the films but by the filmmakers themselves, and we'll let Dave talk to you about that and his plans for San Diego, too.
Happy to spend a moment with artist Dave McKean at a public showing of a series of paintings he calls Nitrate. And Dave, why don't you quickly tell us the basis of Nitrate, homage to some of your favorite silent films?
Yes, obviously the word comes from the silver nitrate stuff that these films were printed on. My first memories of film, really, were to do with the stills, really, rather than the films. And the first book I bought was for myself. Was a book of horror films, stills. And the older the films were, the more mysterious and the more compelling and stranger they were. And those images, those misty, grainy, hard to make out what was going on images, really stayed with me. And they stay with me now. So when I started to make my own films, I kind of went back to what really kicked me off loving film to start with, which was those Strange Images. And it was films from that era, from the 1910s and 1920s, when the language was being created and when the rules were being written, and they didn't really know how to do it. And so you get this wonderful feeling when you start watching a silent film that I don't know what's coming up. I don't know where I'm going to go with it, which is very rare now. Most modern films, from the first scene, you pretty much know what you're going to see, where you're going to go.
They're in the trappings of story, and there was more experimentation, it seems, in this period, and more concern about images as well as storytelling, you
well,
tell me.
Well, the rules of filmmaking had not been established, so stories could hair off in bizarre directions, and then they would have to... if they had to deal with a dream sequence or a doppelganger sequence or something like this, they would have to work out how on earth to do that with very raw equipment.
Absolutely.
Very, very heavy equipment and very basic techniques. And I really love that. I love seeing people struggle with a medium and find solutions, because often the first time you find a solution, it's really magical. You can see their excitement when a double exposure or a cross fade creates an effect that's really quite visceral. And it's visceral now, 100 years later. Imagine what that must have been like at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't help but think of the parallels with some of the innovations of technology now, and that this was really the cutting-edge technology of its time.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, my two favorite periods of filmmaking, I mean, I love lots of them.
Sure.
From across the board. But those early silent films and now.
Interesting.
Because now feels like a new silent era or a new...
visual era, certainly.
A new visual era and a new set of rules being written.
Absolutely.
And people starting to use digital tools, not just to make dinosaurs and spaceships, but to get inside people's heads and show you what people are feeling and thinking, and a whole new way of telling stories is coming out of it.
I wanted to ask about specifically two artists and two filmmakers in particular that you used, Georges Méliès, who a lot of people may know from the Earth to the Moon, the silent film, and certainly the HBO film even made use of the story of Millet as well. Mm-hmm. And I found it interesting that you chose this still. You weren't sure where it came from and what film, and I heard that on this tour you kind of discovered a little more information about it.
Yeah, this is one of the stills that was published, printed in this book. And to add to the mystery, every other film still that was in the book had a film title credit. And this is the only one that didn't. It just said a still from the pioneer Georges Méliès, and frustratingly moved on to talk about something else. And I never knew what film it was from, so I could never see the film. I could never track it down. I didn't know what I was looking for. So yes, a film buff here, a friend of Thomas
McGovern,
tracked it down for me. It's called.
And a phrenology is in the.
Phrenology Valet.
Okay.
The French title. and the English title is something like. The man with the skull and the strap. I don't know what it's called, actually. It's got a strange, terrible long title. But anyway, I have the title written down. So, yeah. And so,
my
final mystery cracked. I'm really glad it's happened here.
Yeah, and it must be surprising to find out the real story behind the, you know, at least a little more information about the film based as opposed to the still that you used as inspiration.
Yes, I mean, it does have a page on IMDb, and it's got a bit of a writer there.
Wonderful.
And he's put me in touch with a great old book, I think from the 60s about Méliès, that has a piece about this film in it. So I can fill in this gap.
Wonderful. And I know this is the beginning of an entire, I think, is it correct? The hope is to make a book of all the paintings eventually?
Yeah, I'm working towards doing a book.
Okay.
And I think there'll be maybe 30 paintings in the book.
There you go.
Like this, and then maybe a few other things as well. But they'll all be based around silent cinema, the early days of cinema.
Another filmmaker, F.W. Murnau.
Murnau's my favorite, really.
That's very cool.
I mean, I love Dreyer and Fritz Lang and lots of others.
Sure.
But Murnau is the one that...
Nosferatu, correct?
I love Nosferatu. He made Faust, which was shown me yesterday, and was absolutely staggering. And he made The Last Man, and he made, and then later on made Sunrise, which was a classic.
Absolutely.
But he's the one that really made film into an art form, I think. And he managed to put on celluloid quite intense feelings. And they're quite startling even now. And we watched Faust last night. And certainly there are bits where the effects don't quite work, and there are some strange choices made. But these astonishing images just keep on coming, and they're very influenced by painting and from theatre. And the lighting is so exquisite. I just think it's one of the most beautiful films ever made.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Now, the tour is leaving Chicago and will be heading towards San Diego for the convention, obviously.
Well, I'm going to San Diego.
Oh, okay.
And Tom is taking a booth to San Diego. I'll have one of my paintings there.
Wonderful. Which painting will be there?
The painting is from the film Destiny, which is a Fritz Lang film.
Very
great
cool.
Great story about a couple whose child dies, and she confronts death in this strange region that only she can sort of penetrate, and death is surrounded by candles, and every candle represents a human life, and death makes her a deal that if she can prove why a life should be saved in these three different stories, then he will give her back the baby.
Excellent.
I mean, that's a strange premise for a film, but it's very beautiful, again. So I've done the Portrait of Death.
And I've seen the painting that is inspired by the Cabinet of Cagliostro and
Caligari.
Thank you very much, Caligari. And my understanding is you're following up with a graphic novel of Caligari as well?
Oh, that's another thing, yes. I'm doing a graphic novel, and it's called Caligaro.
Okay.
Just to be obtuse. It is a sort of rewriting of the story of Caligari, but very different.
Okay.
And the original Caligari had a real, the script had a real anarchist tone at the centre. And the director of the film, Robert Vine, undercut that by putting an introductory scene, an intro and an outro, on the script.
Okay.
And bizarrely, that became the thing you really remember, the fact that this whole thing is a dream and it's actually taking place in an asylum. That was not part of the script.
Oh, interesting.
Robert Vine put that on in the end, and it undercut the message. So the writers were not happy, but out of it came the first sort of great twist ending in cinema. So what I wanted to do was try and find a different twist, which I think is better, but also reinstate the anarchist center. So it is a truly dark, anarchist message in this book, but it will take me a good year or so to do, so that's a ways away.
No worries, we're looking forward to it, and really appreciate the tracks of music, film, and graphic novels that come together when people come to appreciate your work. So as the fire as the fire trucks go by us,
they're coming to get me.
Only Chicago, I'm telling you. No, thank you very much for spending a moment with us. The exhibition is called Nitrate, and we look forward to seeing Destiny at San Diego Comic-Con.
Yes.
And continued success. And I know that the big exhibit is coming in 2010 in Los Angeles.
A large amount of the paintings and a lot of Tom's extraordinary collection of original cinema posters and some projections, all kinds of things will happen in LA.
We will point people to the Century Guild blog and your own blog as well for further information on that. Thank you for taking a moment with us, Dave McKean.
So there you go, Dave McKean at the Century Guild booth at San Diego Comic-Con. Hilary Barda likely doing signings after his panel for the Creepy Comic for Dark Horse, and then go to the Dark Horse booth and check him out in a signing there. And look for Dave's print Destiny along with prints from Jeremy Bastion and Gail Pataki as well at the Century Guild booth. It's all happening at the San Diego Comic-Con. That'll do it for this episode of Word Balloon, which was sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where you get a fantastic selection and value on hardbacks, absolute editions, omnibuses, essentials, trade paperbacks, you name it. And with orders for $50 or more, you'll receive free shipping from InStockTrades.com. A couple of items to look at. How about Signal to Noise, the second edition of the hardcover that has a lot of bonus features in it as well. The standard retail price is $24.95 at InStockTrades.com. You'll get it for just $16.22. We were talking about Creepy. The new edition is out with Hilary Barta, but there are the archive editions collecting the old stuff, the classic Creepy stuff. The standard retail price is $49.95 at InStockTrades.com. You can get them for $32.47. For more of the details, go to their website, InStockTrades.com. John Suntress saying thanks again for listening. We're going to give you more coverage on the road to San Diego with more interviews this week. And then when the smoke clears, we'll be talking to you about all the big news that happens in San Diego. Any questions or comments about the show, you can email me, john@wordballoon.com. Make sure you check our website, wordballoon.com, for a great archive of audio interviews. And now we've added video to the website as well. You'll be able to find some great video interviews I've done recently, touring some of my favorite comic stores, and talking to some of my favorite creators, like Dave McKean. That will be posted as well, along with this episode of Word Balloon. So if you want to get a more fleshed out version of our conversation, make sure you check out the video at wordballoon.com. You can follow me on Twitter, John Word Balloon, and I'm on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you like the show, please leave us a review at iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. And any feedback you have on the show, you can find me either via email or at the Word Balloon message boards as well. Just click on wordballoon.com for the link. That'll do it. Thanks for listening. John Suntress saying Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2009.